Another son down at the coal mine here. He's been down there 5 years.
Coal mine?
Maybe coal mine. Mm-hmm. And the other one, he's married and has 3 children. And I have Jeremy here at home. She's 14 years old, going to school here. And I have Vernon, he's 13 years old, lives home here with us, going to school here. And we have Valley Rose. Valley Rose is the youngest. Another son down at the coal mine here. He's been down there 5 years.
Coal mine?
Maybe coal mine. And the other one, he's married and has 3 children. And I have Jeremy here at home. She's 14 years old, going to school here. And I have Vernon, he's 13 years old, lives home here with us, going to school here. And we have Valley Rose. Valley Rose is the youngest. She's, is it 12 now? 11. 10.
10 years old.
10 years old. And there, that's the bunch. So they're scattered all over the country, and Sally and I hope that we can make it to visit with them next summer.
You'll have quite a trip if you make them all.
Yeah, I should say we will. All right. Well, Harry, now play it back to us.
Okay. Yeah, that's all right. Say, how much did you pay for this here? I'll pay you for these here, because you don't want to buy these for... What's the matter with you?
I got it on the tape.
Huh?
I got it on the tape.
What I do with my coat, these are slipped in my pocket. Do something with it, 92 feet. That's, see, you're in that
22
cent for bills. And this one here is $1.65.
Well, that's all right.
But if you don't want to pay now, leave it go until you turn the whole bill out at once. The pioneers is return the tapes in, unless you want to keep these tapes yourself.
Well, why the pioneers going to pay for the tapes?
But they agreed that in the beginning, you know. But I've never given them a bill because I figured I shouldn't charge them for anything until I turned it in completed, until they get all set up on the rules. Right. That's what all this discretion is. Somebody wants to grab the tape and run with it. Well, why do all this work and have it destroyed? Let's set it up standard so that every member of the pioneers in the organization will have possession of them all the time instead of one individual.
Yeah, and well, we're making these tapes for the pioneers.
That's right. Because I just saved all the slips. I've got them on a thumb tacks on the wall, you see.
Yeah.
Well, now, Frank, you watch. My name is Harry Hughes, and I'll be 62 years on April the 29th, and of 1961. I was born in Linden, Indiana, in 1899, and I have two brothers born in Linden also, and I come to Los Angeles in 1905. And I was in Los Angeles at the time of the San Francisco earthquake. I got a licking over the earthquake. And my father was a building contractor. There's four of us boys and one sister. And my father and mother both passed away. They lived around Whittier and Montebello, down there where there's big fires recently. And I've been around the world and traveling a lot. In the First World War, 1917, I was 18 years old. I worked at San Pedro in the shipyards. I worked in the Fulton yards, the wood shipyards, with axes and broad axes and slips and chisels and foot adzes. And I transferred over into the steel ship, the Liberty shipyards at San Pedro, the Northwest Shipbuilding Company, it was called. And from there, I went out to Prescott, Arizona. And I worked in Whipple Barracks, Arizona, when the first boys from the First World War, the TB and lung cases and gas, boys that were gassed in the First World War, were brought there for recuperation. I was employed by the government. I was on the payroll with the GIs. I eat, live with the GIs, but I drew a civilian pay, $1 an hour, and the GIs drew from $15 to $30 a month. And I was asked to stay there. If I'd have stayed, I'd probably been retired with a pension by now. So I spent 2 trips in Arizona. I went out another time to a couple of years later to wire 11 buildings. My dad took a contract to build 11 buildings in Prescott, Arizona. And I was I've been an electrician since I was a kid. And I was still a kid then, 17 years old, 18 years old. So I had worked in the moving picture studios from that time on up till about 1924. And I talked about going to New York to work for the Moon Picture Companies, and I started out in an old Ford car and $35 in money, and I drove that 1,320 miles from Los Angeles to Everett, Washington. And I knew a fellow there in the town by the name of M.J. Taylor. He was a real estate salesman. He used to be a shingler in the other days. He did lots of work for my dad. So when I went into his office, I was pretty near broke. I didn't have much left. And he told me the names of some of the contractors around there, so I took out and tore out and hunted for a job. And I met a fellow by the name of Ballinger. And he was a partner of Ballinger and Ford. The Ford, this contractor on this air base, is the partner, right down here at Clear right now. So, Ballinger's an ex-wrestler in the Logan days in Washington. So, he didn't meet anybody at that time, so I went away, and before I got back to Mr. Taylor's office, he called me back and put me to work. And I worked a couple of years for him. I lived around Seattle and Everett for approximately 12 years altogether. And so, a little later, the construction work kind of died out, and I went back into electrical business again. I repaired and installed radios and sold water systems, and the refrigerators were just into the coming then. They were just starting to be used in the homes. And I knew Governor Hartley and his family. In fact, I run around quite a bit to dances and parties. I used to go to all the Lorna's dances at Wickersham, Bellingham, Stanwood, up to Chelan, Grotto, Ty, on the old Great Northern Railroad. I used to hop a ride on the railroad and go fishing up on top of the mountains weekends. And in the wintertime, when the ice would freeze, there was groups of us youngsters would get in cars and get out there and ice skate on all the ponds around Cavalier's Corner, Sunnyvale, Snohomish. And then I had a lot of friends from Alaska and the Yukon, and they kept trying to get me to talking about Alaska, want me to come to Alaska. So I moved back down to Seattle and worked for a wholesale radio house. I was their serviceman for all the equipment they sold in the Northwest. That was the F.A.D. Andre Company. The Elsie Warner Company had the jobber's contract at that time, and I had the service job. And I got acquainted with an awful lot of people from Alaska that were buying radios, that we even shipped radios to old battery sets to Alaska. So, this Captain Goddard and his wife and several other pioneers down there kept after me. So in 1929, in 1925, I took a boat ride and landed at Ketchikan with a Coast Guardman. It was on a PT boat, one man and an officer and myself. And we went into Ketchikan and got supplies and walked around town and got back on the boat and went back to Seattle. But there's no official record of that because we didn't register in any place. In fact, it was a government boat and we weren't supposed to be in those waters. So there was no record made of it. But they had a storm in the Bering Sea at Nishigak and Nakhnikovich. There was a high tide come in 1929 and wrecked a lot of Camrys. And they were soliciting around the streets to pick up men to go to Alaska to repair these Camrys. And I happened to be one of the boys who was picked. That's how come all the pictures in my album are over in the Bering Sea. And of course, American Can Company furnished all the machinery over there, and we had to dig it out of this sand and rebuild these buildings. And of course, I was given the job of assembling machinery and working with the machinist and the blacksmith. I built the whole hand pack line for the Nushigak Canner that year. What they call a hand pack line is everything is done by hand from the time they slime the fish and scale them till they get them in the cans. They're cut up in chunks and they even hand salted. So then I went back to the States, and I had a little money in the Marine Bank in Seattle, and I drew it out 2 weeks before the bank went busted. And I went down into California for a trip and come back to Washington and lived around there a little while, and some more of these Alaskans kept after me. And I met quite a few. I met a man by the name of Mike Dozer that had mined up here and struck a hard rock claim and sold it for $11,000. And in 1 week, he was flat broke in Seattle. They really skinned him out of it. He used to hang around an old man's store by the name of Frank Kibble. And I used to be around there and help old Frank. He was a man with both legs off. He'd got his legs cut off in a train wreck on the Great Northern. And he was on a pension. He had this little grocery store. And I used to spend a lot of my spare time helping him out, waiting on his customers and taking care of him. And then I finally decided when they picked me up in Seattle to go on this trip to Alaska. That I was going to come back to Alaska again. And so in 19,
36. I was working for King County, and it was getting towards winter. In the spring of the year, 1937, in May, I landed at Seward, May the 8th. And I come on up to Fairbanks, and I practically stayed in this area continuously since that time. I worked for the Alaska Railroad a period of time. I even went out as a gandy dancer, 42 cents an hour, working on the section. And then I got onto the bridge gang, and I got 94 cents an hour. And I worked with the old-timers here, Chris Clausen, Jack Hansen, and Johnny Blattman, and Clausen, and Sid Sheldon, Bobby Sheldon's brother, and there's one famous character on the Alaska Railroad was known as Mr. and Mrs. Green, Ma Green and Dill Green. They were colorful characters to this extent that they had friends back in Washington, D.C. And she was a relative or a very close friend of a congressman, and she was always pestering him and bothering him for something, so she was sent to the Siberia of America at that time, to Alaska. They gave her a job as station agent, and Bill Green as telegraph operator at Healy, Alaska. And there was quite a lot of talk about that she was the second manager of the Alaska Railroad. She used to give orders and clear out of the blue sky. For instance, there was one old-timer here that was sick and living in a cabin down there near Healy, Gene Tivis. He used to work with the railroad as an engineer on the ditcher and the equipment. And one of the neighbors of mine called and told me that Gene was in bad shape in his cabin. So I went down to see Gene at the cabin, and it was 40 below. And he was sitting up on his bunk and with his stove open, laying there throwing chips of wood in the stove. And this is true. So I went up to see Ma Green. First I asked him why he didn't go to the hospital, because he was a First World War veteran with an honorable discharge. So he said Ma Green told him he couldn't get a pass. He'd been too long off of the railroad. So I went up to the depot, and Ma Green and Bill Green were there, and they gave me quite a lot of static. So I made a request officially for a copper wire, that's the way they termed it in those days, to Anchorage, to the railroad headquarters. And I got the general manager on the phone, and that time Cunningham was acting general manager for Colonel Olson. So I explained to Cunningham my problem about the condition of Gene Tavis, and he told me to go back and get his serial numbers from his discharge papers and bring them up, that he would have a pass to the hospital in Anchorage. So I did just that. And Ma Green advertised all up and down the railroad how she helped Gene Tivis out. That got to me clear in Anchorage from the headquarters office. Well, anyhow, Gene only lasted 5 weeks more in Anchorage. He passed away. He was on his last legs, but nobody would help him. Yeah, those were one of those things that happened. The same as old Jack DeLay. I knew him quite well. I used to visit with him. He's kind of feeble. He's past his 80s, 82 years old, and he needed somebody to look after him. But he didn't like to leave his home, and that was his home on the point of that hill over that the Healy Mine Bridge. That little cabin sticks out on the point of the hill. That was his for years. And there's another character in the country there. It was old Andrew Dragish, a trapper. He hung around Fairbanks a while here, and he didn't want to work. So he went out in the hills and got himself a bunch of traps and built himself a trap line and a bunch of cabins. And for many years, he trapped out in the hills, and he had a fur buyer's license. He used to make pretty good money. And he'd only come in town long enough to sell his fur, and back out he'd go again. He's a little like Earl Pilgrim living off the country. He don't spend much time in town. And then there was another character out there by the name of Lee Swisher, a trapper from Pennsylvania. To my knowledge, he's still alive, living in Pennsylvania now. And, of course, there was Earl Pilgrim was in that mine, which he gave his story on tape to us. We have a one-hour story of Earl Pilgrim's life already recorded. Well, getting back to this trapper, he started a restaurant and roadhouse at a place called Healy on the Alaska Railroad, and he brought out a person by the name of Singleton, and he hired this Mrs. Anna Shannon, it used to be, to work for him. And he eventually married Mrs. Shannon, and they sold out their interest in Alaska and went to Watsonville, California to live. And they built a beautiful home, over 100 feet long in the basement, and the full story, and him and her built that all alone from logs they took off of the ground. There was 50 acres there that he acquired, and built this nice home. And they've sold that property and are on a year's trip to Yugoslavia, where he was born. They plan to come back to Alaska when they come back from the old country. But the brother, Andrew's brother, was a big packer in California, a very wealthy man, and he couldn't leave his interests long enough to come to Alaska with him. They plan to come back to Alaska when they come back from the old country. But the brother, Andrew's brother, was a big packer in California, a very wealthy man, and he couldn't leave his interests long enough to come to Alaska with him. So the brother will probably have his business cleaned up so that when they do get back to California, they'll probably make a visit to Alaska. And they have a lot of friends around the Alaska Railroad District, Harry J. Leek and Grant Pearson and Johnny and Lena Howard that still live up in that district. And, there's so many of them. There's Romanoff's gone, and Hoha's still alive. Marino's gone. I knew all those people. I knew Joe Dalton and Johnny Boucher and Knight. I met Bill Knight. And
did you know that colorful character called Goat Mary? Colorful character called Goat Mary.
Oh, yes. I knew Mary Thompson. I knew when they took her out of here. I knew her for many years. I knew all those people used to come around Healy Mine. I used to go up there and buy groceries and go to the show once in a while. And, of course, I never went to work for Cap. He was always suspicious of me because I wanted to live off the country. There's one time I stayed out 8 months without even coming to town.
Well, Harry, did you know this Emil Yusuf Ali when he first...
Yes, I know when he was cutting wood for Ely Mine, and he had to get his money every day to keep going. Using a team of horses to drag it on the go-devil, that's bad.
Was that what he was doing when he first went in there?
That's what he did when he first came to Lake Night, and I was there.
Cutting wood?
Yeah, cut wood, lagging. They call it for Ely Mine, lagging and post. Now, that's the same as Joe Fern and his partner, Joe Gagnon. And John Fern used to do. And then there was another two or three old-time Finns that lived in that country. And there's one over in the Wood River country. I can't remember his name. He went there in 1908, before the First World War. And he ran away from Germany to keep from getting in the army. They had compulsory military service in Germany way back in the early days. And he didn't know the First World War was fought and over for several years. I met the man when he walked out to the railroad, to the post office, to turn in some gold he'd taken out and get some supplies from the roadhouse. But I don't remember his name. I met Professor Lewis Giddings when he made the trip from Black Rapids over the mountains on the timber line taking core samples for scientific research for the University of Alaska. I met him and took some pictures of him. And I met Iris Scarlin when he was taking the census on skis going across the country here. He'd come down from Cray. That 92 miles in a little over a day and a night, and he stopped at the roadhouse to rest up. That's where I met Ivor. Now we kind of finish this up.
This is some little stories on Frank Young, Frank P. Young, of 1039 Fourth Avenue, Fairbanks, Alaska, and Harry Hughes of 219 6th Avenue, Fairbanks, Alaska. Frank P. Young is a past president of the Igloo No. 4, and he's a trustee in the Grand Igloo of the Pioneers of Alaska. And myself, I'm a comparatively new member. I have been on some committees, and at the present time, I'm second vice president of Igloo 4, Fairbanks, Alaska. This little story we'd like to see converted into writing and as a sample to try out to see what can be done with a little pioneer history and a little to bring the newer people back to the early ways of life, which are the basis for all our future life. And I think a little study along this line would be of great help to the history of the pioneers. This tape is a transfer tape taken in the home of Frank P. Young and transferred at the home of Harry Hughes from a Steelman tape recorder to a Webcor high fidelity tape recorder. And we would like to possibly try a little transcription and put this little story into writing as a starter, to find out what the feeling and learn about how to do this processing of tapes.
we will now go into the story of Frank P. Young and little sketches of experiences of Harry Hughes in his early days around Alaska.
Now, Frank Young, you give me your name and the year you was born.
Frank
when
P.
you entered Alaska?
You go ahead and talk. Frank P. Young, born in Seattle, came to Juneau in 96 with my parents. Went into Dawson in the early days, 1900, and arrived in Fairbanks here in 1905. Sold papers here in the streets when I was a boy. And seen all the great events of the early days. Soapy Smith and Skagway, E.T. Barnett and Pedro and Fairbanks, and many, many other famous characters of the early days of the Yukon and Alaska.
Did you know Walter Loomis, the miner?
Oh, yes. I knew Walter well.
What did you know about him that will be of interest to that?
Well, I think this Walter in later years was a steamboat man. Well, I knew him when he first came in the country area, mining out on several creeks around. But I would just have to get thinking back to get to where I could.
What's the first bad fire in Fairbanks you remember about?
1906.
How bad was the fire?
Well, it burned up the whole town. Burned all Front Street, which is the main drag. There's just a few cabins left out around on the outskirts.
Anybody get burned yet?
No, not in that fire.
No loss of life?
No, but there was fires later on. There were several burnt to death.
Do you remember the name of some of the boats coming here?
Sure, I remember them all.
Well, let's put them on the
table. The big packets used to come up here. The Julia B. Well, Laval Young was not a big packet. That was a big boat, but it was Laval Young. The big packets, unless it was high water, they stopped down here at Chena. But in the days before they built this dike out here and lots of water come into this slough, and the water was high, these big packets like the Sarah Susie and the Hannah and the Julia B. And many others that I can't remember now. Used to come right to Fairbanks here. In fact, they got pictures of them out here.
What was down at Chena Village? What was, somebody told me there's quite a town there.
Well, that was a headwater, navigation in those days. They were going to build a town down there. That was going to be the big
River Fort,
that's right. And they had, they had stores, and they had a light plant, and a newspaper. In fact, I got one of the old newspapers here, published down there in 1904.
Well, they tell me Joel Oates, Sr., helped build the first light plant here in town. Do you remember any of that?
Oh, I guess Joe did, all right. He worked as a blacksmith around. He helped to build it all right. He was here at that time, and he was a pretty handy man any day.
Joe Oates Jr. and Freddie Oates haven't brought that diary down yet for us to record. See, they're going to bring Joe's diary. Joe Oates was a member of the Yukon Order first, before he was a member of the Pioneer Order at Nome first. That's where he belonged first. We've got that much depth with him down.
Yeah, his name down there in the charter there in Nome.
Mm-hmm.
I seen that down there last fall when I was down to the Van Diego convention 2 years ago. No, well, just a year ago now, wasn't it, Dolly?
No, a year ago last October.
A year ago last October? Yeah, that's right.
Well, Now you continue your story of your life on this reel, what you did over the years, and bring it up to date in brief.
Well, in the early times after I got out of school, I took in all the stampedes in the country. Did some mining on local creeks out here. And never got rich at it. Did a lot of hard work, a lot of hard digging. And then I got into carrying mail into the Kiowa country from Fairbanks here. Was at that 2 or 3 years. Did some steamboating in the early days.
You have dog teams?
Yeah, that was all done by dog teams. That was done in the winter in that contract.
Give a description of how you outfitted yourself to take off to haul this mail. What your loads were.
Well, our loads consisted of, I think it was 300 pounds of mail. We had to make a trip once a month. And very little perishables, only something that was a necessity that we carry in that distance. That was a long ways, you know, from here to Tallinn and from Tallinn overland into Wiseman. Approximately 450 miles. And we had plenty tough times. The weather was cold, and we run into some of these cold snaps on the trail. In other words, one trip especially I made in there, I just about got in there and got out again without freezing to death.
Have you had any exciting experiences in close calls that you tell us on the
table? Oh, yeah, I've had several. I mean, in the line of cold weather.
Disaster on the trips and so on, yeah.
Well, we stayed in there one time at a relief cabin. I forget now how many miles it was from Tallinn, but I should think about 80 or 100 on the way into Wiseman. And we got in there and she dropped down. We couldn't tell how cold it was because we had no thermometers. We was in one of those little relief cabins there, and we was there for about 10 days, and finally we was running out of not only dog food, but food for ourselves. So we decided to go slow in this cold weather and see if we couldn't get out of it or get to our destination up in Wiseman. First day out, while we traveled, and finally we got so cold, we decided we'd make camp. But when we started to make this camp, we were so cold we couldn't even put the tent up.
Who generally traveled with you? Travel alone, or is it people you met?
Well,
give the names or something.
Most of that was done with an old-timer by the name of Roy Lund.
I know his name.
Yeah, he was a mail carrier here in the early days. He later got a mail contract down here on Richardson. He used to carry the mail from here to...
Oh, yeah, Roy carried it when I come to the country.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it was him and I most of the time.
How about Bill Burke? Different ones down.
Well, Bill was carrying the other way. He was carrying in towards Kuskokwim, wasn't he, Dolly?
Well, no, he carried down Ron Hood across the way. He was down the lower Yukon.
Well, anyway, to get back to this putting up the tent, we managed to get a fire going. Just a nip and tuck proposition. And we got this fire going, and we kind of... After we got her going good, well, we kind of thought out enough to get the tent up, and it was a real tough, hard deal, and we just barely made it. It might have been 60, it might have been 70, we didn't know. But man, surviving in that kind of weather with a bunch of dogs and being out in that for several hours, he's in a pretty bad condition. One little misslip, might have been fatal for the both of us. In case we couldn't have got that fire going, that would have been it.
What kind of equipment did you carry to protect yourself in an emergency?
Well, how do you mean?
Well, in the way of aids to build a fire and tools to work with?
Oh, we always carried everything like that.
And this is the equipment that you normally carried it for self.
Well, we carried two good axes, we carried matches, and we carried birch bark, and we always carried food to last us a week.
What kind of food?
Well, mostly, bacon and beans and there wasn't fat.
Sourdough pot,
that's right. And anything like that that we could, it could freeze, it wouldn't hurt it, and we just get it on the fire and thaw it out and go after it. Then we used to carry a lot of this jerky, and sometimes we'd carry salmon strips, put them in the hoodie or parka, you know. Take a chunk whenever you're kind of feeling a little bit hungry.
You know John Olette very well?
Oh, yeah, I know John. That's French John, yeah.
What did he used to do mostly?
Well, the first time I ever seen French John was up on the Salt Jacket about over 40 years ago. He was poling a boat going up the Salt Jacket when I seen him in years. And he was a good river man, good man with a boat.
He told me years ago that he poled the Rivers family in here in the early days in a poling boat, brought them into Fairbanks area. When there's all little kids.
Rivers?
Mm-hmm. The Rivers family. He brought the family up. He poled them in on a poling boat. He told me that himself.
The Rivers family was not here during the real early days.
No, in later years.
Oh, later years. They might have been down the river there someplace where he'd pick them up. He might have, maybe low water or something. But the boat couldn't have gotten up here. Why, he might have brought them up. But during the very early times, the Rivers family was not in here. Them years I speak of, I speak of 1905, 6, 7, 8.
John used to tell me a lot. I can't remember all the names of them, but he told me about lots of people around here when I used to have him work for me down in Indiana.
Yeah.
See, I hired all those natives to work for me.
You ever tell me about the time he shot the otter and fish and what was it else, was it, darling?
Fish and two otter,
one shot.
How'd he do that?
Tell him, darling.
Well, he was doing a little trapping down around the Indiana River.
Otter was fighting over a fish in the water. It was up over the
bank, so he shot right straight down on him. And shot the fish and the cushion
killed the two otters.
He got the
three of them. One shot.
Well, otter was pretty valuable skin then.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
See, a silver fox was worth about $1,200 when I come to the country.
Yeah. Well, I was trapping 1 year after these martin, and I got into a bunch of these black martin. We'd get from $90 to $110 a skin. We really stacked up the dough there in about 3 months.
There was a joke, old man Barlow at Ferry had trapped over in that country for years, and 1 year he caught 7 silvers and he brought them to Lignac, where I had a cabin there, and laid them out on the floor.
Hmm.
And one of the buyers there bought one right out of the string. It was a choice skin right away. But this fur buyer wanted to know how I knew the difference in skins. He thought I was pretty green. I laid him out in the value that they were.
Say, is old Barlow alive yet?
Yeah, they took him outside.
Well, they took him out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you say they, who do you mean?
There's some friends of his. There's some people, he had some friends.
Oh, is that right?
He used to make some friends. You remember he used to come in town and some people take care of him?
What have become of his mining firm?
I never heard no more about him. And Kosky, Joe Kosky might know, or some of the others from that fairy country. But I haven't talked to him for quite a few years now.
Mm-hmm.
I did see Barlow here when he was in town about 2 years ago.
Yeah, he was in the hospital there a long time, yeah.
And did you ever remember Jack DeLay, a freighter?
Jack DeLay?
Mm-hmm. He was a famous ball player when he came to Alaska in the 1890s. 1897,
98. No, I don't ever recall.
He lived at Healy in his latter years. He was 82 years old when they took him out of Healy, Alaska, now in Alaska Rebel, Healy Fork. And he had two brothers and a sister in Bellingham, and they come up and got him. He used to tell me lots of stories in the early days in the dog mission.
No, I didn't recall him around here. He might have been in my around where he was, but I didn't recall that name. Well,
you Well, keep on. Now, how many members of your family? How big is your family? And give the names of your family on the record.
Well, it was 10 children.
You raised 10 children since you've been in Alaska.
Well, I've raised 10 since I've been in Alaska. Of course, we haven't got them all raised yet.
Well, you start with the oldest one and give me the name.
The oldest name. One is Frank L. Young. He's 45 years old. And the next is Thomas Young. By the way, Frankie lives here. That's the oldest boy. And Tom J. Young is in Indianapolis, Indiana. He's married and has a family of 4 children living there, has a home there. And my daughter, oldest daughter, she's married and they have a homestead up near Chena Springs here. And then I have another daughter, Frances, that lives down in Los Angeles, California. I have another daughter, Tana, that's living close to Keesler Air Force Base, Mississippi. And I have a son down in Alpaco. Is that the name of it?
Alpaco, is it?
Alpaco, Mexico. It's about 1,500 miles below the border.
Down past Acapulco.
Acapulco. That's the place.
I've been down into Mexico on a trip.
Yeah, Acapulco. Mm-hmm.